Hello and welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is David Baird from Gigmore. But first, the big news of the week, Pandora buys RDO. Now, many of you don't even know who RDO is, but they've been a streaming service, an on-demand streaming service, for quite a while, and they've actually built up a pretty good following of about 1 million people, which in this day and age is really good, not enough to stay in the game, and that's why they've gone into bankruptcy. So Pandora has made a very strategic move by coming in and paying $75 million for the infrastructure. Not the business, and really for a handful of employees, so not the whole staff either. What makes this interesting is the fact that Pandora is a non-interactive service, and what that means is it operates like a radio. You can't go in and search for a particular song. What Pandora does is it looks at your tastes, and it provides a playlist according to those tastes, and the tastes, of course, of what you played before. But you can't specifically find a song. That's called on-demand. RDO has all the infrastructure for that. And that's what Pandora needed, because it turns out that most people would prefer an on-demand service rather than an uninteractive service. And this is brought out by the fact that if you look at Spotify's numbers, they're going up and up. You look at Pandora, their user numbers are pretty flat. So Pandora saw the writing on the wall and went and tried to get into the on-demand game by buying at least the good parts of RDO. Now, here's the thing about Pandora. Their service now only applies to North America and Australia and New Zealand. They're nowhere else in the rest of the world. So even though they're fairly big here, and they have about 70 million users, so they're fairly big here, they're a big player, they can't expand. And the reason why is they could never come to terms with the licensing organizations in other countries. So having the on-demand part of this together now makes Pandora more attractive to the licensing agencies in other countries. So they'll be able to go in and negotiate those deals finally and expand. Now, there's a number of other factors involved here. So first of all, Pandora just bought the infrastructure, the streaming infrastructure. That's it. They didn't get any of the users. So basically, RDO's users are dead in the water. The second thing they didn't get is any of the licenses. And of course, one of the big things about streaming music or any kind of digital music online is the fact that you need licenses, especially from the major record labels. If you don't have them, you're dead. And the record labels really want a lot in order to give you those licenses. They basically want a lot of money up front. Plus, what they want is part of the company. So it'll be interesting to see what happens now that Pandora has to go back around and renegotiate these licenses. And it also takes a long time. Dealing with the major record labels is not for the faint of heart. And even those who are good at it, like Apple, really takes a lot of time for this to come together. So it should be interesting to see what happens with Pandora in the coming months. It was a great move on their part because it's the only way that they can keep up with Spotify. And now, of course, you have Google Play, you have YouTube Red, you have Apple Music, and you have Amazon with Amazon Prime Music sneaking up there in the rear. So there's a lot of things going on in that space, in the digital music space. And now we're going to see even more of Pandora jumping in the game big time. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn a lot more about it. The next thing that happened this week was interesting. The RIAA introduced a high-res music logo. So they did this in order, in their words, in order for the public not to be confused any longer whether they were getting high-res music or not. The only thing that doesn't make sense about this, well, there's a lot of things that don't make sense about this, but the biggest thing for me is the fact that they classify high-res music at 48K 20-bit. Now, when is the last time you recorded something at 20-bit? Probably never. In fact, that's not even an option on most DAWs these days. So why they chose 20-bit, I don't know. The other thing that's interesting here is Apple already has been classifying high-res music as anything over 44.1 but 24-bit. If you're 24-bit, as far as Apple is concerned, with their Mastered for iTunes program, that means that you are high resolution, or what you're providing is high resolution. So here comes the RIAA, and they say, oh, no, we're going to change this. In order to use our logo, you have to be 48K 20-bit. Now, what I want to know is, why don't they just set it at 96K? Because let's face it, most of us look at 96K as kind of the threshold for high res. If you're recording and you get to 96K, you're thinking, okay, it's going to sound really good. I'm recording in high resolution, and just about everybody thinks this way. So why shouldn't the RIAA? The RIAA has something else on the agenda, which I don't know what it is. I'm trying to find out, but there's something else going on behind the scenes. Now, remember that the RIAA is the Recording Industry Association of America, and it's made up primarily of the major record labels and their subsidiaries. They don't much care about consumers. They care about their clients, which are the major record labels. If you recall back about 10 years ago, no, maybe a little more, 15 years ago, the RIAA was really behind the high-res formats at the time, SACD and DVD audio. Why? Well, it had nothing to do with the consumer. It was all about the fact that the patent for the CD was about to run out. So what they needed was a new product to replace a CD. So in comes SACD from Sony and DVD audio, which everybody else used, and okay, let's hope that the public will now buy into this and buy a whole new set of records that they already own. But it didn't work out that way, and that's because the music-consuming public only cares about convenience. Quality is a distant second. It's always been that way. Convenience is the big deal. And if you just look through history, go from vinyl records, for instance, and go to cassette tape. Why was a cassette tape important? Well, it was more convenient because finally you can play it in your car. You couldn't play a vinyl record in your car, but you could play a cassette tape. And then, of course, we went to the CD. Well, why is a CD better? It was random access. Instead of having to wind, fast forward, or rewind to get to the song you wanted, you just hit the number and it went directly there. So again, it was more convenient. Why did we go to the MP3? Well, because it allowed us to choose just the songs we wanted instead of having to buy a CD with 10 tracks that we didn't want because we only wanted the hit. Now we could do that. So again, it's more convenient. Why is streaming more convenient? So now we don't have to store any of the music on any of our devices. So it's more convenient having it in the cloud. So as you can see, there's a history of this. There's a history of convenience trumping audio fidelity, unfortunately, but that's the truth. So anyway, there's something else behind this RIAA high-res logo. I'll let you know what it is when I find it, but for now, it's just causing a lot more confusion than it should be. My guest today is musician and technologist David Baird, who's created an easy way to meet other musicians online with a site called Gigmore. Not only is Gigmore a way to meet musicians of similar skill levels, but for clubs to find artists and bands as well. I talk with David about his service via Skype. How would you describe Gigmore?
Gigmore is a live music marketplace that solves the problem that talent buyers and emerging talent face in trying to find each other, connect, and transact. So we've started out as a musicians network, connecting musicians through our matching services, and are rapidly evolving toward the full-fledged gig matching or live music marketplace that I just described.
Was that intentional, or did that just happen on the fly, so to speak?
It was always intentional. I've played music in bands my whole life, and I was pretty familiar with problems faced by musicians. And what we decided to do was start with the musician matching service, which we knew we could build and gain a critical mass of musicians. But the strategy always was to evolve as we are toward what I used to call the holy grail for bands of, you know, connecting them to paid gigs.
Yeah, that's for sure. The one thing all musicians want are gigs. When you solve that problem, you basically rule the world, I think, because again, as a musician, you can rehearse, you can practice all you want, but until you get in front of people, that's the fun part, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the experience, you know, the way I look at it is there's two elements to what that makes that experience great. One is obviously you're performing in front of an audience and you're getting feedback from them and, you know, hopefully mostly positive. And you just that fact that everyone's in a shared space in that room, you know, listening to the music in the moment is great. And then I think, you know, sharing that with the other musicians on stage is just a really rich, powerful experience as well. I mean, I'm sure you know the musicians you've gigged with, you just end up with this bond that, you know, maybe it's like a sports team, you know, or something. But yeah, it's really one of life's best experiences.
Yeah, it's funny. You might not even like the person personally, but you're right. There is that bond regardless. You can make wonderful music and not like anybody in the band. You know, it happens all too often.
Yeah. But that if you have good musical compatibility, you can get beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. How did the idea come about?
Well, I, as I mentioned, have played in bands, played music my whole life, but my wife and I moved to LA about 11 years ago from New York, where I had a band just on the side. And I thought, well, I'm moving to LA. Hey, it should be easy to find musicians to play with, should be easy to find places to play. Well, I was wrong on both counts. But really the genesis of the idea was that when I moved out here, I had a real challenge, and it was a lot of time and effort to find compatible players who wanted to play, you know, who were of a similar playing level, who had similar goals to mine, and obviously liked the same kind of music that I liked. So, you know, having been in technology, I realized, Craigslist is really where most people go, and it's really not solving the problem. It's just a static set of listings that expire within hours. Matching technology is perfect. And so that was when I started to look around. You know, that was the genesis of the idea that became Gigmore.
You know, when I first came to LA, I guess it was 1980 or 81, and there used to be a service, and it lasted for quite a long time. It was called Musicians Contact Service. I think you paid $30. I don't remember if it was $30 a year. I don't think it was a month, but everybody signed up for it. And I was surprised because there's even some touring gigs and, you know, a few high-level gigs. I remember the Chili Peppers actually advertised on Musicians Contact Service looking for a guitar player. So you're right, there's a need. It was filled at some point in time and hasn't been for a while.
Exactly. And it's you know, what I like about it as a business opportunity and as somebody who's used to, working with large audiences, all musicians of all ages and levels need to connect with other musicians. And whether you're, you know, starting out in your basement and you're still in high school and you want to, you know, find people to play with, or whether you're working professional where you need to find more gigging situations, working professionals are really just like freelancers, and they need to manage, they're always networking. The smart ones are always, you know, hey, here's my card, or, you know, and so, once again, technology just, could put all those people together more efficiently. And it's a recurring need, and it's a widely, it's a need that's, experienced by a large number of people.
I noticed that you did a crowdfunding campaign, or is that still going?
Yes. It's ongoing. And, we're moving toward a goal of raising, you know, what is a decent sized seed round for a startup like us, and have right now almost 200 investors who've committed on the platform. And it's a brand new paradigm for individual investors, because unlike Kickstarter, where you can contribute to somebody's campaign and maybe you'll get, you know, their product at a discount or a free t-shirt or something, the crowdfunding campaign we're doing is an equity-based crowdfunding campaign, which means that individuals can participate in the growth of an early stage company like ours and buy shares. So when it's equity based, that's what that means. But the idea is to reach a lot of people, and not everybody, you know, necessarily has the big dollars to invest, but you can participate with $200. And, you know, our intent obviously is that that will become really valuable over time. The contrast, by the way, was, you know, on Kickstarter, Oculus raised a bunch of money on Kickstarter and then was bought by Facebook for several billion dollars. And all the people who contributed on Kickstarter received nothing because it was not equity based. So this is a result of the SEC's new regulations, which really changed in June.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought that was against the law, and the SEC was really against it. So happy to know that's changed. That's cool.
Yeah, I think the idea is to democratize early stage investing. And it was always restricted to this category called accredited investors. And I think, you know, there's been a movement over time that, you know, should that opportunities like this should be opened up really to everybody, or almost everybody.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. That's very cool. So tell me about the market that you're addressing. Who is your market? Who's your customer?
Well, as a marketplace, you know, we will have both sides of the marketplace as customers. You know, right now we have 45,000 musicians and bands on the platform. And so they've been, you know, our primary customer since we came out of beta a little over a year and a half ago. We have over 500 industry professionals on the platform. And that's obviously the other side of the marketplace that we want to grow. It's going to, you know, I think as it evolves, I think the demand side of the marketplace, which is the talent buyers and the people doing the hiring of bands, will become a very important segment of our customer base for us, because they're the ones spending the money. So they're the ones who are, you know, going to look to us to provide the most value. And if we can do that, you know, the talent will continue to flock to our site and join up if they know that there's, you know, gigging and career opportunities there. So we're shifting our focus increasingly toward the bookers and the talent buyers who, you know, are the ones that are sort of the next wave of customers we need to adopt and use our platform.
What would be the advantage for a promoter to use your platform as opposed to the way they've always done it?
Well, the way they've always done it is just the way described with musicians trying to find each other. It's very inefficient and sort of in the digital stone age, if you will. The bookers that I know of receive well over 100 unsolicited emails every day from bands wanting to, you know, perform at their venue. So they're totally overwhelmed and have no basis for knowing who's the next Imagine Dragons and, you know, who's going to bring their mom and their best friend, and that's it. So there are two main ways we're creating value for them. One is simply the convenience of a technology platform. It's like Open Table. I don't call restaurants for reservations anymore because it's easier to just grab my phone, type in, you know, here's where I want to go, 8 o'clock, you know, reservation for two, done. Don't have to speak to another human being. Don't have to go back and forth. I can see what's available and select it. So there's a convenience associated with technology that is one big advantage. But The second big advantage is we're developing a metric for bands' popularity and credibility and track record, which we're calling a gig score. And in fact, the first iteration of that is launching in a couple of weeks. And what that will be, as our goal is for that to become an industry standard, you know, almost like a FICO score or something that helps talent buyers filter out the talent that is on a sort of upward trajectory, that has, you know, a fan base in a specific area, and that fan base is growing. So really, it's a kind of a big data play, where our first iteration is using the Gigmore metrics that we are tracking internally on our network. But shortly after launch, we'll be pulling in data from basically all relevant data sources that will wrap into an algorithm, this gig score, that we think will have a lot of value to talent buyers, to help them evaluate and discover talent. It'd be as a analytical tool.
That sounds great, David. But I think the number one metric there for most club owners, promoters, managers, etc., would be the number of people that a band or an artist draws. And how would you get that data?
Well, over time. And this is one of the challenges of building a marketplace, and, you know, whether that's Airbnb or Uber or anybody. Early on, we have ways of selecting from the data sources that we'll be using, basically regionalizing that data, so that we will have information about a band's fan base in a specific area. And the specific area, obviously, that's relevant would be the area of any given booker or talent buyer. So that's partly what the matching engine will do, is it will filter out and present as new matches or potential band candidates to a talent buyer, bands that meet their criteria for genre, but also for audience size or potential draw in that particular area. I'm not going to say that that will be the way it works on day one, but it will improve over time and become increasingly accurate, not only from the data that we collect from external sources, but as bands and venues transact on Gigmore, we will develop a history of a band's gigging history and a venue's history of bands that ultimately would be kind of like a poll star for indie bands that will also have data and credibility that we will bake into the algorithm. So, you know, it's going to be an evolutionary process to achieve the ultimate, you know, sort of predictive tool. But we sort of have a roadmap for doing that, and we'll, you know, be tackling it incrementally, step by step.
It occurs to me that a lot of this is basically a digital version of an agent. Because really, that's what the old-fashioned analog agents did, is they developed, based on their credibility, guaranteed draws, and then, you know, they would go and suggest whoever was in their stable to a particular promoter or club owner or whatever that would fit and would eventually draw for them. But this is, well, again, it's an open table concept where, you know, a club owner wouldn't have to go to an agent, wouldn't have to talk to anybody, and just find out online, right?
Yes. And we've called it a virtual booking engine. Where I'm a little bit cautious is, you know, the music industry, as you well know, is full of complexity, and you know, in some cases, legitimately, there's a lot of subtleties to hiring music, to discovering talent. There's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of risks. And even having been in technology for 20 years now, and having an enormous faith in what technology can do, I'm hesitant to say, you know, we're replacing human beings. And so I'm hesitant to say we're replacing any particular industry role, because I think that it's a complex picture, as I said. So I think that it'll be very interesting to track who uses us, and for what, and for whom we're creating the most value. And it's not something that you can predict, you know, with a lot of certainty. And I'm trying to think of, you know, there are many examples of technologies that were created for one purpose and then turned out to be actually much more useful for something else. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen with us, but I am just hesitant at making any big declarations that we're, you know, actually replacing any players in the music industry as it exists today. We want to be a tool and a convenient platform for a wide swath of people in the industry, and you know it remains to be seen exactly, you know, what a disruptive effect, if you will, that would have on any different segment. You know, in some cases, booking a band is pretty darn simple. It's, you have a date, you have a price, you have a location. You know, you could do it with a couple, you know, listen to a band, you know, online, watch their video and just click, you know, hire this band. In other cases, obviously it's not so simple. So, you know, we're going to move down the path, and while appreciating the complexities of it all, and not, you know, so I think that's a fairer plan for us. We think there's a big business in it for us, one way or the other, without saying, you know, we're this or that, or you're taking over this or that segment. I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, it does. And actually, it's interesting because there's a couple different segments here that I can see, and I'm just going back to my club days, which, you know, that wasn't in the recent past, but the way it used to work was, as opposed to now, was when you got a gig or you went to a club owner, the club owner basically knew that the first time, second time, maybe even third time in, you weren't going to get a big crowd, and it would eventually develop over time if you were good enough. And so the club owner took a flyer on you, basically, just to see what would happen. But it's different in so many venues today where everything is based upon the number of people that you can bring.
There's still, I think, an element of taking a flyer on a band for that first gig. But if we can take some of the uncertainty out of the picture and present talent in a compelling way that makes that talent buyer's decision easier, then, you know, we've truly helped them. And then over time, if they do a good job, then rehiring that band using our platform will also be easier, because you could simply, you could do it electronically. You could, not, instead of doing email back and forth, you know, you can have a platform that makes it really easy to book a band again. And also, our plan is to offer a payment processing platform, so it's easier to pay the band as well. So, I think there's still an element of that, but I guess in so far as we're trying to take some of that risk and uncertainty out of it, I think we can provide value. But I was familiar with those old days, just as you were, but I still find it happens. It's still happening.
I mean, I could see this as a very valuable service to clubs and venues, in that, let's face it, there's a lot fewer of them than there were, and they're not increasing in numbers. if anything. But the big problem is that most of the times they may have a great band that isn't drawing and there's not enough people coming in to actually support the venue. And mm-hmm. I guess if there was something like GigScore that would be a reliable source of talent that would actually do that, that would get them X amount every night, that would be a way that they could be assured they'd have a certain amount of support to at least keep the doors open, which, you know, that's good for everybody if that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition, there are, you know, there are so many different places that you know, bands play, where people hire bands, clubs obviously being a big component of that. But there are, you know, there's also colleges, there's festivals, there's private parties. You know, there's a whole host of places that, you know, people hire bands that are not just, you know, the professional club. But to your point, I mean, clubs, you know, are sort of dark, you know, half the week, simply because they don't have anybody to play there, or there's too much risk in hiring somebody to play there. If we can, again, take some of that uncertainty out of it for them, you know, there's a possibility that we could help them increase their business, because, you know, God knows there's plenty of bands. It's just a matter of being able to get some more certainty about how many people that band could bring in.
Yeah, definitely. Since you've launched, you're out of beta now, right?
Yeah.
Are there certain categories or markets that you're addressing that surprise you, or demographic?
That's a great question. You know, I think I had kind of, the whole thing has been kind of a pleasant surprise, because when you, you know, have an idea and you kind of put it out there, you know, there's a possibility you're just crazy. You know, it's, the response has been, you know, great. But I think that the biggest surprise is the incredible variety of musicians who have joined up. And again, it's younger teenagers up to guys in their 60s whose drum set was collecting dust and they just want to get back into it. So I think also that the other thing is that pretty early on, you know, as I described, we saw ourselves as a musician matching site that was replacing Craigslist. But early on, talent buyers of various types came on the platform and started messaging bands saying, you know, we need bands for a bluegrass festival in Minnesota or whatever. So without us, you know, even building out the marketplace as we envisioned it, people started to use the platform, you know, for all kinds of purposes. So I think that's the other, you know, pleasant surprise.
Is the service free for everybody? Free for clubs as well as for musicians? How does that work?
Yes, it's totally free right now. Ultimately, that needs to change, because obviously we're a business and we have expenses, and we've invested our own money in this in order to build up this service. So later this year, we will be launching a subscription service that we think is reasonably priced, that will help us grow and help us build, you know, a viable business, so we can, you know, create a sustainable business model and be around for decades like we want to be.
The subscription is for who? Is it for all parties involved, or just musicians or clubs, or how does that work?
Okay. Since we're still building out the gig matching piece of the marketplace, the initial subscription will be, you know, a package of features for musicians and bands.
Okay. So it's features beyond what you have now?
It'll be what we have now and some additional features, yes.
Yeah. Very cool. Is there a best way to use the platform right now?
There is. That's a great question. I think that people need to create a complete and accurate profile of themselves. It doesn't take that long. It takes, you know, 5 to 10 minutes at the longest. With music,
pictures with all the genres they play, with some an interesting bio of talking about themselves. Number one, because then that will get them the most relevant matches. If you just put down you play rock, you know, that's too general, and you will get a wide variety of matches of people who also play rock, but that may not be their principal, you know, genre. So being specific and complete in your profile. Secondly, generate matches when you log in. And I think a lot of people understand that every time they log in, the system looks for potential new matches for them. And thirdly, if you delete irrelevant matches that don't work for you, it frees up room in the system, because we have a maximum right now of 35 matches per account. It frees up room for other newer, more relevant matches. So I think the whole idea of a complete profile is a great way to get value out of the service, and sort of managing your matches is a second one. And then finally, if you're a band, the way we match you with musicians is you have to define your desired instruments. It could be one, it could be five, it doesn't matter. And we will match you only with musicians who play those instruments. So I think a lot of people join as a band and may or may not complete that in the profile creation process, and don't realize that that's the way to get very specific matches that are bringing you musicians exactly who you're looking for.
Are the matches made by algorithm? Is that kind of the secret sauce that you have?
Yes. Yes. We have our own formula for musical compatibility, which is based on location, first and foremost, obviously, the genres you play, your instrument, and your playing level and your goals. So we kind of, those are all components of the algorithm.
How is playing level determined?
It's self-determined. So when you create your profile, you define your playing level.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, one last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either learned along the way or you received from somebody?
I think it is that there's so much focus in our day and age, and it really goes across a number of industries. But let's say in the technology industry, there's so much focus on the unicorns of the business, you know, those companies that have achieved over $1 billion in valuation.
Yeah.
And, you know, every time you pick up the paper, every time you look at TechCrunch, whatever, it's the same big companies that have really just hit it out of the park. And I think as an entrepreneur, the best advice I've kind of gotten is those are the Tom Cruises of our business. So, you know, for every Tom Cruise, there's 10 million other actors, you know, and don't focus on that, because if you do, it's pretty easy to get discouraged. And, you know, somebody likened being an entrepreneur and growing a company to football, which takes place at 3 yards at a time in a cloud of dust. And we all think of like the great one-handed catch that won the Super Bowl, or the, you know, the running back, the kickoff, you know, for a touchdown. But most of football is grinding it out 3 yards at a time in a cloud of dust. And I think that when you're reminded of that from seasoned entrepreneurs, even those who've achieved pretty big success, that's helpful, because that's just... That's the life that you live as somebody, you know, building a business one step at a time.
Well, that's kind of the same thing on the creative side as well, where so many times artists either compare themselves to, you know, Bruno Mars or Katy Perry or, you know, whatever, the 0.1% that's unachievable. Yep. And, you know, that could get in your head and actually stop you from getting anywhere. So, yeah, it's the same thing, I guess, all over, right?
Yep. No, exactly. Yeah, they're. It's funny that the tech business, you know, being based, you know, on code and technology and so on and so forth, but there's a lot of similarities to entertainment.
Yeah,
just as you just described.
Yeah, definitely. Well, this has been cool. Thanks so much for your time, David, and good luck with Gigmore. It's a great idea, and I'm sure it's going to do really well. It is already. You can find out more about Gigmore at gigmore.com. That's GIGMOR.com. One word, GIGMOR.com. Gigmore. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I love your questions and comments, so please send them. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Many thanks, Steve, for putting the show together. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.